WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. The purpose of investing in the stock market is to make money, but there's a growing number of investors who have a second goal, to encourage the growth of socially responsible companies. My guest Peter Kinder is the co-author of a new book about this growing movement called Investing for Good. Kinder is a partner in Kinder Leidenberg Domini & Company, which provides information to investors on socially responsible corporations and their performance in the market. He told me about the social criteria he uses to evaluate corporations.
Well, we screen under a number of headings. The headings that we screen under are South Africa, alcohol, tobacco, gambling, military weapons, nuclear power. We screen for product quality and consumer relations, environmental performance, corporate citizenship, employee relations, and employee diversity.
Now, South Africa, is that, you know, the boycott's been lifted and everything. Why are you still screening for South Africa?
We will screen for South Africa until Mr. Mandela says that he would like the sanctions lifted. He has not indicated that. And until he does, we will continue to screen on South Africa.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of conflicting impulses you'd probably have if you're trying to find socially conscious companies to invest in. And in your previous book on ethical investing, I think you gave a really good example of a typical dilemma someone might be in. This was the story of a woman who was advised to drop a drug company stock because they invest in South Africa. And she said, "No way, this company makes my insulin. I'm diabetic."
That's right. That's right. There are many dilemmas of that type. We try to represent in the Domini Social Index the broadest range of screens, but in reality, people are very selective about those screens in their own personal portfolios. And you'll also see that the social funds run the gamut of broadly screened funds to ones that have fairly narrow focuses. For example, the New Alternatives Fund really looks at new environmental technologies. The Green Century Fund has very rigorous environmental screens. And you will see in over the next year other funds that will address particular niches in the social investment movement.
You've been writing about socially conscious investing for over a decade, I think. Well, under a decade, I guess.
Almost exactly.
We've narrowed it down. Almost exactly a decade. And I know you're up on something of the history of socially conscious investing. Do you see a big shift in what kinds of screens are being used, or, you know, what the criteria have been?
Oh, yes. There's been a dramatic shift. When we first got into this field, and actually I should say that my wife, Amy Domini, got into this field long before I did.
Mm-hmm.
But when she started out, the only screens that really were implementable were ones that were negative, that you could identify the, say, 10 largest emitters of toxic chemicals. You could identify the worst of the forest product companies. You could identify the top 100 military weapons contractors. So the screens were really negative. What has happened over particularly the last 5 to 6 years is that investors, while they still will apply those negative criteria, are really looking for positive stories. They're looking for the companies that really make a difference in society. For example, Nordstrom's has one of the best records of hiring women in line positions and in their executive suite. The companies like ISCO Products, which provide environmental measuring devices for pollution control, and also have superb records of hiring the handicapped. Those are the kinds of companies that social investors are now looking for.
How did you get involved in socially conscious investing?
I met my wife. She was then a broker, and she had been interested in socially responsible investing for some time. I come from a legal background and had been trained that if one did not like a company's management or policies, one sold the stock.
I thought you were going to say one sued.
No. in those days, one had far fewer grounds to sue. But no, it was that you had the Wall Street rule, which is if you didn't like management, you sold. Mm-hmm. That was all there was to it. And frankly, when Amy introduced me to this concept, I thought it was crazy. I did not see the potential for it. Didn't see how you could influence corporate social behavior. And she strongly convinced me otherwise, primarily by introducing me to the shareholder activists. And with that piece of information, it suddenly all made sense to me. Because in Professor David Vogel's phrase, and I wish I could claim this for myself, what we're really up to is lobbying the corporation. And the only way you can lobby a corporation effectively is to own part of it. And that is the role of the shareholder activists. We ourselves are continually asking corporations, and I mean this on a daily basis, we'll be talking to anywhere upwards of 20 or 30 corporations. We are raising with them the questions that our investors are concerned about: hiring policies, environmental policies, product quality issues. So we are really politics by other means.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Kinder, co-author of the new book, Investing for Good, Making Money While Being Socially Responsible. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Kinder. We're talking about socially conscious investing. He's the co-author of the new book, Investing for Good. Tell me if you hear this a lot. The purpose of investing is to make money. It's not to affect social change or to further your political agenda. It's to make money. So you just look at the companies that have the best performance data and you invest in those, and it's foolish to bring in the whole idea of social issues into investing.
First, I think there is no reason why you can't accomplish both goals. In our studies, we've seen every indication that you can. Secondly, I think it's very important to understand that money is not separate and apart from the rest of your life. Money is an integral part of your life. What you do with it has consequences, not just for who you are and what your objectives are. They have larger consequences. And if you really are concerned about an issue like the environment, like employee relations, like diversity in the workplace, why not put your money to work to further those objectives?
Well, the answer to that question would be from the people who don't think this is an effective way to make money, is that the social investing doesn't have as good performance record as just plain old investing for profits. What data do you have on that?
Our data comes from the Domini Social Index, which in its 3 years in existence has performed better than the Standard & Poor's 500, which is the generally accepted benchmark for large capitalization portfolios, large stock portfolios. That's preliminary data. We have not been through a full market cycle from boom to bust to boom. But there have been other studies which indicate the same thing. There is no necessary give back to the market, if you will, for investing according to your principles.
You mentioned the Domini Social Index. This is something that you co-created with your wife, Amy Domini. What is it?
We realized 4 years ago, 5 years ago now, that we were getting a question every time we went out to talk, and that was, if social investing is such a good idea, where are your numbers? And we could point to Amy's numbers. We could point to her employer's numbers. But there was no outside benchmark like the Standard & Poor's 500 or the Dow Jones Industrials that showed how a social portfolio would perform over time. So we set out to create one. And what the Domini Social Index does is measure the performance of a broadly screened market basket of stocks, 400 companies, over time. And our index is particularly designed to establish those types of numbers for socially screened portfolios. And the reason for that is that large segments of the Standard & Poor's 500 are not suitable, not acceptable to social investors. For example, Philip Morris and the tobacco stocks, Circus Circus and the gaming stocks, Seagram's and the alcohol stocks, the nuclear power companies. These are not companies that are going to appear in a social portfolio. And they figure largely, in fact, the only utilities on the Standard & Poor's 500 are nuclear. So it's simply not an appropriate benchmark. That's why we set out to create it.
Tell me the other reasons why you decided to create a social index.
The primary reason was that we felt that we had a responsibility to create the same kinds of financial indices and financial data that other investment professionals had. We wanted to make social investing professional, if you will. We wanted to give it all of the attributes of other disciplines in the investment field. And we're working in other areas as well.
What are some of the companies that are now on the Domini Social Index? And how did they get there? What are some of the things that they've done that you've approved of that have, you know, landed them on your list?
Well, we've given some of the examples. So I can give you a couple of examples of controversial companies that are on our list. Amoco has been on our list. They have been extremely active in community development. They make loans for low-income housing. They've invested in low-income housing. They have an extraordinary corporate giving program. That's on the positive side. On the negative side, they do not have the best environmental record in the world. But we felt on balance that Amoco belonged in our index.
It was that controversial because a lot of people assumed that no oil company would be on a socially conscious index?
There are people who take that position. Mm-hmm. There are two views on that. One is a kind of best of the industry view that you mm-hmm. take the best, assuming that there is a best. Mm-hmm. For example, I think it would be hard. You'd be hard pressed to come up with a best strip mine company, but you take the best of the industry, or you take the view that the industry itself is inherently bad, and therefore you will not invest in it, and both find expression in social investing.
Mm-hmm.
Another company that I think is particularly good is Herman Miller. This is a furniture manufacturer. They have remarkable employee relations and employee participation in decision-making, profit sharing, and the like. Hewlett-Packard is also controversial, but they too have very strong employee relations and very strong product quality controls.
With Amoco, which you said was a pretty controversial choice for your list, cynical people might say, well, they have a bad environmental record, and sure, they're involved in doing some community good. That's public relations. They have to do that to boost their image. And, you know, you're being a sucker and falling for it. The cynical view.
Well, if that wasn't backed up by Amoco's dollars going into the community, I probably would subscribe to that. But what they do is tangible. You can evaluate it. You can see it. And the people who are in the community verify it. We make great efforts to verify corporate claims. We do not accept them at face value. However, you're touching on something I think is very important, and that is I don't mind corporations wrapping themselves in the environmental movement, and I don't mind them saying we have great community relations and asserting that, because that sets a standard by which I'm certainly going to come back and ask them questions. So I think that corporations who wrap themselves in these issues and assert their virtue are setting standards by which they're going to be judged. I think that's all to the good.
Mm-hmm. Peter Kinder, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Kinder is co-author of Investing for Good. This is Fresh Air.